Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is the best way to keep on top of all the latest news from China. Subscribe to our Access program and tap directly into our digital newsroom through our Slack channel. Receive discounts on tickets to our conferences and free admission to our live podcasts, plus early access to the podcast. SubChina is a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and I am in New York this week, where I'm joined by the notorious Jin Yumi, known in some quarters as Jeremy Goldcorn. Jeremy, of course, is editor of SubChina. Yumi, please greet the people.
Yo, people, how you doing?
So China's sharp power has been the subject of a great deal of discussion within the community of China watchers in the last year or so. Concerns have grown over influence operations or even efforts to interfere in political processes through Chinese embassies, through consulates in Western countries, or through the work in those countries of the United Front Work Department, which is something Chinese President Xi Jinping infamously described in a speech in 2014 as a magic weapon.
So today we are going to focus on the country where the debate over this has perhaps been the loudest and where there is arguably the most at stake. I speak, of course, of Australia. We have seen a heated kerfuffle over the publication of a controversial book by a prominent Australian public intellectual, Clive Hamilton. The investigation into an Australian MP named Sam Dastyari, his resignation in January over his acceptance of donations tied to China, and a couple of dueling open letters issued by scholars of China.
So to talk about these issues in Australia and the similar debates that are now happening here in the U.S., we are delighted to welcome David Brophy, senior lecturer in modern Chinese history at the University of Sydney and a prominent scholar on Xinjiang. David wrote a widely circulated and highly critical review of Clive Hamilton's book, Silent Invasion, China's Influence in Australia. He was also the author of one of those open letters, which was signed by dozens of prominent Australian scholars of China. David happens to be here in New York, and we are very glad that he was able to join. David, welcome to Seneca.
Kaiser, hi, Jeremy. Great to be here.
We are also joined by Andrew Chubb, who is a postdoc fellow this year at the Princeton Harvard China and the World program. Andrew did his doctoral work at the University of Western Australia, and you may have heard him on our recent show about nationalist public opinion and China's behavior in the South and East China Seas. Andrew was a signatory to David's open letter too, and has involved himself in this debate as well. Andrew, welcome back to Seneca.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great. So before we get started, I want to point out first that I have made no secret of my own position on China's influence and interference operations. And, you know, my concerns over what I strongly believe has been an overreaction. My views are very much a matter of public record. I recognize that with the author of and a signatory to that first open letter, the one that's more critical of the overreaction, we haven't invited the other side, as it were, but I do want to do our best to represent that side's views dispassionately in the course of our conversation. And I also want to be sure that our guests talk about, you know, their own bona fides. I mean, by my lights, neither of you guys is exactly an apologist. You've written a lot of stuff that doesn't exactly toe the party line in your academic work. So why don't each of you tell us a bit about your own research? Andrew, why don't you go first and maybe establish some of these critical bona fides?
Sure. Well, as we discussed in the earlier podcasts, I study Chinese public opinion and foreign policy issues related to maritime disputes in particular. And so I think, bona fides. How does that give me bona fides?
Well, I'll give him bona fides. He's not a panda hugger, okay?
No. I mean, you're talking about, you know, belligerence, often some quite bellicose behavior, and China's kind of truculent position on a lot of maritime disputes. In fact,
I've written about democracy activists. I've written about propaganda strategy. written about China's intentions to control the South China Sea.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. And then what about you, David? You're a Xinjiang scholar.
So. Yeah, I'm primarily a historian of Xinjiang, so I deal with some pretty sensitive issues. There, I first went to Xinjiang in 2002, then I spent a year there in 2003-04. I ended up writing my first book on the emergence of a Uyghur national movement in the early 20th century. So it's a story that takes place on both sides of China's border in the northwest and touches on a whole range of issues that are extremely difficult to discuss in China today. So I don't imagine I'll be appearing on the shelves of Beijing's bookshops anytime soon. But I, you know, alongside that, I do also write commentaries on the situation in Xinjiang and give commentary to the media as well. So I'm very committed to the importance of maintaining our legitimate criticisms of China and certainly resisting any effort to stifle that criticism.
Okay, but let's talk about Sam Dastyari. What is he alleged to have done, and what lessons should the Australian public take away from the scandal he was embroiled in?
Well, so there's two aspects to the Dastyari scandal as it's unfolded. The first concerns the question of political donations. So Sam Dastyari was involved in soliciting very large donations from some Chinese donors. One of them in particular, Australian citizen, one whose citizenship application is still pending. And you know, alongside that, he seems to have got himself into a quite intimate relationship with these figures to the point he was actually forwarding them his private bills for things like laundry and so on, which is certainly not a good look. So initially, that was the first thing to come out, and he took a hit around that. The second aspect to that was a story that emerged later, involving a meeting that he had with one of these gentlemen, Huang Xiangmo, in which he is said to have indicated to Huang that, given that it was on the public record that Huang was, a figure of interest for ASIO, it might be better if they leave their phones on the table and step outside. And so somehow that came out, and this was blown up into a sort of an espionage scandal. And that was, I think, the final straw for Sam Dastyari. So that's basically the basics of
actually a South China Sea angle to it, too.
Oh, really?
There was, when the first time Sam Dastyari got demoted, it followed after the revelation of some comments that he made to Chinese media about the South China Sea being China's internal affair.
As an MP?
As a senator, yes. But specifically to Chinese language media, he was feeding... As a certain politician in Australia once said, feeding the chooks, so sort of giving the media what they wanted to hear.
Is that an Australian expression?
There was a particularly nasty character in 1970s and 80s Queensland politics called Joe Bjelke-Petersen, who sort of ran a bit of a police state and at the same time kind of kept on top of the media pretty effectively by feeding them whatever it was that he thought that they wanted to distract attention away from his dodgy regime.
So, David, as I mentioned that you had written a review about Clive Hamilton's book, maybe we should start by talking about the whole controversy over its initial publication and how that was handled. Can you review what happened for our listeners and tell us what the popular telling of this gets right and gets wrong?
Yeah, so I suppose the first thing I'd like to say is that I'm very glad that the publication of this book wasn't prevented. It's very important that we can have all voices participating in this debate, and I really hope now that it doesn't attract any kind of litigation. Clive Hamilton did have some difficulty getting this book published. We don't have all the facts available to us, but the story as it's emerged in public is that the lawyers at the publishing house where he usually publishes his work were hesitant to take on this book immediately. They were continuing to look at it, requesting revisions, counseling delay, and Clive Hamilton decided that he wanted to get it out as quickly as possible, so took it elsewhere.
So it's not true. That's important to underline. It's not true that the book was actually censored in Australia or prevented from being published. It was that the publishing house wanted to take some extra time.
And they were fearful of what?
Well, the narrative that emerged was that this was ultimately a threat from Beijing. Now, Clive Hamilton was happy to admit that there were no specific threats. there may have been some wording in one of the letters from the publisher that they worried that some unidentified agents connected to Beijing may have a hand in pursuing the book after publication. But reading between the lines, basically what the lawyers were worried about was the fact that there were already defamation cases proceeding through Australian courts arising out of some of the reportage around this Chinese influence story throughout 2017. And Clive Hamilton's book was largely a compilation of that reportage. So it was predictable that it would contain a number of the same stories. And so it's not that surprising in that case that the lawyers at Allen and Unwood would be hesitant.
Right, they now, cover their asses as lawyers are trained to do. Right?
Yeah. I mean, the only way we can assert that there's any connection to Beijing here there is if we simply assume that any Chinese Australian who would take legal action against the book in the aftermath of its publication would be acting as an agent of Beijing. And that's precisely the allegation that these people are taking legal action to contest.
Who had actually taken some of the earlier legal actions against the reportage that you spoke of?
Well, there's Huang Xiangmo and in fact, no. Is Huang Xiangmo have a defamation case? Chao Chak Wing definitely does.
There have been three cases.
And he's another very wealthy, ethnically Chinese Australian with ties to the mainland.
Indeed. Chao Chak Wing is one of the donors who had connections to Sam Dastyari. He's a very prominent donor and prominent in public life. There are three cases so far. Two of them have been settled. One was a case that Huang Xiangmo took against the Herald Sun, against allegations that he was a Chinese spy. The Herald Sun settled. They apologized. There was a second case involving one of the young Chinese women who was interviewed for the Four Corners story that's really at the heart of this story.
And maybe you should ID that, the Four Corners story. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Four Corners program aired in, I want to say, sometime early in
June
the second half of June 2017. The title of the program was
Power and Influence.
Yeah, Power and Influence. It was a story that ran the gamut of a series of stories involving quite high-level intrigues in Canberra, stories about Chinese students, stories about protests that had been mobilized for the visits of visiting Chinese dignitaries, and so on. One of the young women who was interviewed for that program, who was presented as having admitted to being an informant, essentially, for the Chinese embassy among the Chinese student community. She objected very strongly to the way that was portrayed, and she found a no-fee law firm to actually take that up, and that case is now settled as well.
Right. So one thing I think that's important to point out in terms of the ABC and Fairfax investigations, which did raise some important issues regarding Australia's, particularly its domestic political setup, is that the whole thing was kind of framed, introduced by a very cloak and dagger kind of reenactment scene about a raid on a suspected spy and the discovery of sensitive documents in the house of a person who was suspected of spying for China. And then it proceeded to sort of, as David mentioned, run the whole gamut of these various different aspects of Australia's relations with China and China's influence within Australia, which includes all sorts of other things which are really quite far removed from spying. And in fact, the insinuation that it is a form of spying, for example, the Chinese student groups or political donations and things like that, is really quite misleading. And so the framing, although the investigations raised some important issues, I think the framing was a big problem with that.
Hmm. David, with as little normative language as you can manage, what are Clive Hamilton's claims? And then separately, is there anything that he basically gets right?
Right. So the claims really run the gamut from very big picture issues. So the first chapter essentially claims that China has as its ultimate goal reducing Australia to some kind of vassal status, including up to the point of actually making territorial claims on the Australian mainland. That he considers that a distinct possibility in the future. It then runs through a range of different issues that are set within that larger background. This includes a very strong point that comes through is his emphasis on China's success up until this point in co-opting, subverting a range of institutions and elite groups through politics, the media. He paints a picture of the Australian elite as essentially pro-Beijing and inclined to sell out the interests of ordinary Australians to further their mutually beneficial relationship with China. There's a number of other aspects that he touches on in terms of China's specific activities to restrict the free speech of Chinese citizens in Australia. That's a whole other sphere that's worth discussing as well.
And he talks at length about this issue of sort of citizen spies, which kind of ties into the whole of society threat that's been talked about here. Christopher Wray, the public.
Which is the notion that just ordinary Chinese people, you have to be suspicious of them because they're informal agents of the Chinese state.
Right, and that's sort of on record there in his public testimony.
Hmm. This is achieved in part by a methodology of connecting the dots from party through United Front to community organization down to, say, student association, and then just sort of collapsing those links. So you get to the point where student organizations on campus are simply arms of the Chinese Communist Party, that the student activity, therefore, has to be seen within the terms of a national security threat. There's various different points at which he, I think, pulls out Chinese actors from a wider context of comparable activity, which then allows him to link all these different stories together that creates the impression of a systematic, coordinated Chinese campaign to achieve these ends. And I think that is part of the real problem with the book, that it's not so much that the stories that he's pointing to, the facts that he's presenting don't exist, but the way that they've all been framed in terms of this bigger picture of a concerted Chinese effort.
It's connected dots to create sort of a conspiratorial...
And the dots are real, basically.
Well, look, take
the
Dastyari.
The framing has been...
The Dastyari case, for example. I mean, the donations are real. Sam Dastyari was clearly willing to spout a much more pro-China position on the South China Sea to solicit these types of donations. But unless we see that within the wider context of a political system which is really awash with money in Australia, that both parties are very eager to fill their coffers with all sorts of donations, be it from China, be it from domestic lobby groups or so on, then I think we're creating a distorted picture of the situation there.
So, I mean, again, there's smoke here, but there's also a fire, right? I mean, maybe help us to separate the two in this Australian context.
Yeah, what should Australians be concerned about?
Well, one thing that I'm trying to do in a sort of little project that I've got going at the moment is to really disaggregate all of these different issues that have been strung together under these sweeping labels, such as Chinese influence operations or United Front work. And really, there are a lot of them, and they're quite different. They come from different causes. They have different relationships to Australian law, different relationships with, say, democratic values. So, for example, just to run through a few of the various things that have been brought up in relation to this discussion, we've got espionage, we've got donations to political parties, we've got lobbying and cultivation of ties with politicians. We've got interference with the free speech rights of dissidents and opponents of the Communist Party regime within Australia. We've got control or influence over diaspora media, so Chinese language media within Australia, which have been well known to have become increasingly pro-Beijing over recent years as they've been serving a different audience. We've got mainstream Australian English language media cooperation deals, so inserts of China Daily into Fairfax newspapers and ABC content sharing arrangements. The list goes on. We've got overseas students activism. We've got the vexatious or so-called vexatious defamation problem.
Mm-hmm.
We've got the funding of academic institutions and think tanks, so things like the Australia-China Relations Institute and the Confucius Institutes. We've got academic self-censorship. All of this has been bundled up together under this
Chinese invasion.
Silent invasion is one way that it's been framed, yes. But even, you know, in less maybe alarmist terms, the Fairfax investigation that sort of complemented the ABC investigation that we were talking about before, that was headlined, you know, contained lots of important investigative journalism in there, but the headline was, you know, China's Operation Australia. Operation implies that there's a, you know, it's a coordinated action that is directed from Beijing, which when you think about the list of things that are bound up in that discussion, that's probably not an accurate way of understanding that sort of a broad-ranging set of issues.
At the same time, you can see why it has become so knotted and how difficult it is for an ordinary person to be able to twist these things apart.
Well, just to take a couple of examples that, show you the different causes. I mean, David was mentioning before money in politics. So if it's the case that Australian or American politics is kind of awash with money and that money talks in our, you know, flawed democratic political systems, then it's probably not surprising that as China and Chinese citizens have more money, that they will be increasingly engaging in that moneyed political process. That's different from an operation directed from Beijing to, you know, subvert a Western country sovereignty. Again, if we look at, say, Chinese students engaging in nationalist challenges to their lecturers, challenging them to not refer to Taiwan as a country or to demand that maps reflect China's view of different territorial disputes. It's not at all clear that the consulate is telling them to do that. And it's not something that you can necessarily jump to that conclusion about.
Or just something that should be handled at the federal level. It should be maybe something that's, you know, at the level of the institutions themselves.
Right, precisely. And if there is a problem in those examples, the Chinese students expressing their sort of patriotic desire to see Australia's maps corrected, it's not in any way contrary to free speech principles. They can make that demand. They can make that request as loudly as they like. The only time that becomes a problem to free speech principles is if the university simply caves into to that sort of demand and doesn't show any regard for standards of academic freedom. I just wanted to point out another example of where the sort of multiple different causes that are at play in these various issues. The defamation action or the threat of defamation action is very much a result. I've been speaking to some lawyers about this. You know, they tell me that there's nothing out of the ordinary about the kind of fear that people of Chinese background or with connections with the CCP would potentially pursue defamation action.
And Australian defamation law is considerably more lax than it is here in the US.
Australian defamation law, right? I mean, legal scholars have a fairly strong consensus that Australia's defamation laws have major problems in terms of defences of things being in the public interest and responsible journalism not being adequate to allow free speech. But again, that's not a conspiracy directed from Beijing. That's a deficiency or an outdatedness of a particular aspect of Australian law.
Let's talk about the dueling letters, as I've described them. The first written by David here and signed by, among many others, Andrew, and by our friend Jeremy Barmet. Again, you know, somebody with really solid critical bona fides. I mean, he's never shirked from heaping criticism on the party. I mean, starting with your letter, David, what prompted you to write this? And Andrew, what did you find compelling about it that that made you among the first signatories to it?
Well, I have to correct you, Kaiser. It was more of a collective effort, this letter. There was a lot of input from a variety of colleagues because there had been a kind of a collective forming of people who were concerned about the direction that the debate around Chinese influence was going in. So that was really what that letter tried to distill. But because it was an intervention into a debate around the specific security laws that had been proposed in the wake of this story, we did also want to stake out a position there. So the letter basically did two things. I mean, it pointed to the fact that we had serious concerns about the impact on civil liberties the ability of scholars in particular to engage in public discourse around questions that touch on Australia's foreign policy. And this is the type of thing that journalists have expressed concern about as well. And they've actually received some guarantees in the revised legislation that they'll be protected, but there's nothing for nothing for academics yet. But the second point that we were trying to make in the letter was that we felt Parliament would be proceeding under a misapprehension were they to enter into this debate on the assumption that, yes, the community of China scholars in Australia had consensus that China was this immediate threat to our sovereignty, that we wanted to really indicate that a lot of us had qualms and misgivings about various aspects of the debate as it had been conducted, and also the fact that we wanted to caution politicians as they engage in this debate. We have to be really careful that this doesn't spill over to create fear and paranoia towards the Chinese-Australian population.
Which Australia has a long history of.
Absolutely. I mean, this goes back right to our founding moments. The first act of legislation to be passed by the Australian Federation was, of course, the White Australia policy.
That was the first. I didn't realize
it was the first act. You know, it was a top priority for the Australian Parliament. And this is, you know, this is not to say that people who are engaging, you know, in the debate from the other side are in any way motivated by nostalgia for those types of stains on our record, but it's not something that we can brush aside. It's something that we have to be vigilant towards the whole time. And as well, we have to, I think, solicit as wide a range of voices in this debate as we can. We have to make sure that Chinese Australians in particular have full freedom and confidence to participate in this debate and put forward critical viewpoints without feeling that they'll be branded an apologist or a stooge for Beijing and so on. And unfortunately, we've seen that type of discourse develop.
And here too. What about the second letter? What do you know about it and its origins? And would it be fair to characterize that second letter as more pro-Clive Hamilton than the one you wrote and signed?
I think implicitly it sort of took on an interpretation of the first letter that... how do I say it? No, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what struck me...
Is it really supporting Clive Hamilton?
I'm not the first person to point this out, I'm sure, but it strikes me on reading the two letters that, I mean, save for, you know, a few important points, the clear purpose of the second was, you know, it's a challenge, it was a rejoinder to the first, but the commentary that was surrounding it, not actually included in the second letter, for instance, in the media, by Feng Chongyi, for example. I mean, he talks about saying that you were implying that there was racism at work. I've seen this in a lot of places. But to my reading, the two letters are remarkably similar. They actually make the same sorts of appeals to, you know, the openness of Australian society. And
yeah, and I actually wrote a piece a few weeks ago trying to identify, in fact, just what the disagreements were. Because they are actually a lot less than the sort of, original letter and then rejoinder that sort of seemed to be correcting the record type of thing that kind of setup would suggest. One thing that I was able to, in that article, I sort of distilled it down to sort of four points of disagreement.
Mm-hmm.
One of them being the scope of CCP activities within Australia. So as David was mentioning before, the rolling together or the connecting of dots that range from all the way from espionage to, say, student activism and things like that, vexatious defamation claims, whether you roll all of that together into one China's Operation Australia, or whether you say that the Communist Party, you know, conducts a range of political activities in Australia, but not all, you know, pro-Beijing, pro-China speech within Australia is necessarily
directed
a result of this Beijing-directed United Front strategy. So there's a disagreement there in terms of the scope of what is in fact a result of the Chinese government's attempts to exercise its influence abroad.
Mm-hmm.
Another disagreement is sort of over this question of racism. So the second letter's premises really seemed to be that the first letter somehow implied that the debate was motivated by racism. And in fact, the point that was made in the first letter was actually that it's the inflammatory and sort of uncareful alarmist language that risks fanning racism at the margins. Not that the people who are engaging in this discourse are racist,
right,
but rather that it has the effect of increasing racism. And there's been evidence of that already within Australia.
Not surprising at all.
Yeah. Not particularly surprising in the immediate aftermath of the kind of storm that emerged in the middle of last year. Another disagreement sort of concerned the idea of sovereignty. So, and the idea that there is a sort of a systematic scheme on the part of the Communist Party to undermine Australia's sovereignty, when I think we can probably all agree that there have been violations of Australian sovereignty in terms of things like, say...
Would you consider the censorship of the Taiwan fish a violation of sovereignty?
Jeremy, you want to explain that really quickly?
I should do that. So if you're not aware of it, why don't we get an Australian to explain it? David, can you tell us what happened?
So as far as I'm aware, this took place in Rockhampton, which is in the north of Queensland.
So that we can summarize for our readers as pretty Australia.
Remote part of Australia by Sydney-sider standards, anyway. There was an artwork being installed in a public space. This was produced by a young girl, very
year
young,
11,
I think, who's at least her mother
background.
Was Taiwanese. And this was a animal shape, I think, some kind of horse, perhaps. And on it were painted various flags. And one of these flags was the Taiwanese flag. And she'd written Taiwan in Chinese characters on it. As well, the story then seems to be that the Chinese consul or someone from the consul contacted local government. We don't know exactly what they said, but put pressure on them to deal with this before the opening of some kind of trade fair in Queensland at the time, and they complied. They complied with this, which
they explain their compliance in a sort of strange way too. Yeah.
Yeah, he said they were bound by Australian foreign policy. I think that was they're making things up on the run now at the moment. They seem to have been extremely out of their depth in dealing with all this, which is often the case. You know, these things arise in places where people are least equipped to deal with them. You know, it's like the business school classrooms on our campuses and so on. There's clearly no law in Australia that says that every work of public art must comply with Australia's foreign policy on the status of particular countries. And I think it would have been quite straightforward for the council to simply tell these people that they were barking up the wrong tree and they weren't going to back down. Effectively,
that a year 11 student's drawing of a fish with a flag of the Republic of China on it is not a matter of foreign policy
it does not rise to that.
But this is a good example of the sovereignty
question. Right.
And you had one more, for some people, that's a violation of sovereignty that they even asked this council to do something about this offending flag. Whereas, from my perspective, I would not see that as a violation of sovereignty. I would see that as a case of the council failing to
uphold sovereignty,
uphold the civil rights of citizens and artistic freedom. But that's different from a violation,
a willful violation
of sovereignty.
Absolutely. And the fourth, you see a fourth difference between the two letters.
Yeah, so the fourth difference of the letter is really the relative emphasis on domestic versus international threats to civil liberties within Australia. The first letter was really, as David mentioned, a response, in fact a submission, to the parliamentary review of the bills introduce sweeping changes to Australia's espionage laws, as well as introduce a foreign agents registration system and ban donations from any foreign source to Australian political parties. So the first letter regarded that as being a more immediate threat to academic freedoms than the various actions that have been highlighted on the part of the CCP and of Chinese citizens, whereas the second was sort of speaking more in support of getting some legislation through the parliament as a matter of priority.
Right.
Whereas the first letter is sort of saying, well, we need to step back, you know, take a deep breath, disaggregate the issues, and consider this carefully. So the second letter was a little more gung-ho, I think, in terms of...
Yeah, I mean, this is what I've said on my argument boils down essentially to, you know, our interest is to preserve this civic fabric that we hold so dear. What is the more pressing threat to it, the actual Chinese influence operations or our propensity to overreact to that threat?
Precisely, yeah.
Right.
So, I mean, I think the three of you at least are all in broad agreement on this. What about the China watching world in Australia? How much of a schism is there on the attitude towards this issue?
I think, as we've discussed, there's a lot of agreement between these two letters, and I think that reflects a wider conversation that is taking place across these lines within the Australian China watching community. I think that one of the reasons that people responded with the letter was this sense that the China watching community was coming under attack from loose talk about China specialists being bought off, you know, having sold out to China. And that I think is quite a dangerous narrative that's taken hold. And I would hope that whatever side of the debate people come down on, that we can refrain from slinging around accusations of apologist, or capitulationist, and so on. That type of language is really corrosive of the collegial relationship that we need.
And so far, that's been avoided, do you think?
Yeah, in my experience, it has, actually. Well, I've spent the last few months in America.
In the academy, among academics, it's been avoided, but perhaps not in the
media. Yeah, I think more could be done to generate spaces for the debate to be carried out in person, with opportunities to actually thrash things out with the time necessary. I think it's, you know, the Australian China watching community is a pretty small and scattered community, so we don't actually get much chance to talk about these things face to face, but I hope that we can do that. What I'm worried about, though, is that there's a wider political context that may continue to stir things up in a negative direction. So the laws that I've been talking about, they haven't actually gone to the parliament yet for debate, and they will be debated in the next couple of weeks. And given the way that politicians in Australia were very free with accusations about people being a Chinese agent and so on last year, I just do worry that we're going to enter another period in which those types of accusations are being leveled back and forth. And I really hope that we can avoid that. That's one of the reasons we wrote that letter, to try to preemptively
put a bit
stave
of
that off.
So both of you have spent a fair bit of time in the United States recently, David and Andrew. What do you think of how different is it? Are there strong parallels between the situation in the US and Australia? And maybe we can start with the nature of Chinese efforts at influence. Are they following the same game plan? How well have these efforts worked? And do they pose a real threat? The different population sizes and economies and level of dependence on China make the situation rather different in Australia compared to the US. So, yeah, what do you think? How should we see the similarities and differences?
Well, the demographics are quite different. And, of course, the basic geopolitical context is, of course, quite different. So Australia is an American ally, but it's located in a region where China clearly would like to weaken the American alliance system. And so that's the context in which this is being discussed in Australia. When you're talking about China and America, you're dealing with the great power rivalry that's at the center of all this. Beyond that, I think all the various issues that have arisen in Australia, I think if you look for them in America, you can find them. And the stories are starting to come out. I think there's a much more concerted campaign around the Confucius Institutes here. That's one thing that I've noticed. There is a very strong push, it seems, to actually abolish Confucius Institutes in Australia. And we haven't yet reached that point. I think even people who've been extremely critical of Confucius Institutes, and I myself don't see it as an ideal model of scholarship on China by any means, but here you've actually have this strong push, and it's now being backed up by people like Marco Rubio. So it really looks as if things are starting to snowball here. There's clearly a lot of symbiosis between the discourses. There's been back and forth both. My perspective actually is that it was the talk about Russia in America that actually provided a bit of a template for a way to talk about Chinese influence in Australia. You had people like James Clapper come to Australia last year. He said, what Russia did to America, China is doing to Australia. Hillary Clinton was just out in Australia actually saying the same thing. Then the sort of the story developed in Australia and then was in a sense exported back to America by people coming over here and talking about, you know, Australia is the canary down the coal mine.
Right.
I think that the narrative that a lot of people in America have received about Australia has been very much dominated by that that alarmist perspective.
So I've described Chinese influence operations in the United States, at least, as being clumsy and ham-fisted. As being obvious, you know, sort of discernible from a mile away, as ineffective, in part because of its, you know, inelegance and everything, but also because we have a certain natural immunity to it in a plural society, or we ought to, at least. You know, illiberal ideas and influences just aren't supposed to take root. Although I have to wonder whether our immune system has been compromised recently. But in any case, they're also, and this is what I really want to talk to you, is they're mainly defensive. It isn't like they're trying to undermine epistemic norms or you know, as the Facebook ads that Russia took out seems to have been, you know, to pit people against one another on the issue of race. There's no effort to do that. It seems, by my lights at least, to be focused on deflecting or diminishing criticism of China, to sort of plowing the field, for more acceptance of a PRC narrative.
I'm not sure that necessarily is just defensive.
Okay, though. No, that's what I'm asking. Where do you see the offense?
Well, I think defense and offense obviously depends on what you see as the status quo.
Sure.
Offense being something to change the status quo and defense being something to preserve it.
But I mean defensive of China rather than trying to...
Defensive of China's image and its reputation and its China story and its narrative. In an increasingly offensive manner. There have always been people outside of China expressing a range of views about the CCP, about reforms in China, about the way the Chinese foreign policy, the way things that should go. And I do think that there is an increasingly strong effort on the part of the party state to try to shut that down. And so from that perspective, I think you could certainly say that there's an offensive aspect to it. If you want to frame that overall in a larger kind of idea of defense of China's image throughout the world, you know, take that to its logical endpoint, then you basically got China kind of cleansing the world of criticism of China.
Still, I think it's qualitatively different than what Russia has been alleged to have been doing.
Yes.
I think the anxieties around China and Australia do derive from a very real policy dilemma that Australia faces. It's the one that people like Hugh White have long been pointing to about the question of maintaining our staunch pro-American foreign policy while being so dependent on China for our financial prosperity. And that's a very real question. You know, my position is not just that everyone should just calm down, we can just continue. There's no contradiction here. We can continue to get rich and be an American ally. I think that there's clearly signs there's a question mark as to how sustainable that will be. And I think that is what's really been the driving force behind this turn on the part of the Turnbull government towards a more confrontational stance towards China. I think that is what has led to this new wave of reporting around Chinese influence, which doesn't correspond to any actual strong uptick, I think, in Chinese activity. But there is something there for Australians to be concerned about and to grapple with. My perspective is that it's very dangerous for us to imagine that we can commit to continue to play this role of backing up a heavy militarized American presence in East Asia. I think that just in the long term, that's not viable, and that's going to get us into a very messy situation. As much as we would like to imagine that we are in there fighting for democracy and rule of law or things like that, actually what history shows is that engaging in a great power rivalry in a place like Asia means that we're inevitably going to get our hands dirty.
Right.
I think we need to, we need to think about ways to diffuse this conflict before it gets to that point.
Let's go back to the US. In May this year, there was a Wilson Center It's a think tank in DC, and Kaiser spoke at the event, and the event was all about, you know, Chinese influence operations. A man named Wang Huiyao, who heads a think tank that looks at, among other things, returned students, was originally scheduled to speak, but he dropped out after Senator Marco Rubio went after the Wilson Center for not disclosing that Wang had some affiliation with the United Front Work Department. I mean, it took me a minute on Google to find Wang's affiliation with the United Front, so I hardly feel the Wilson Center was guilty of, you know, hiding anything. And I thought it was extremely regrettable that the guy didn't show up, because I would have liked to hear what he would have said.
Exactly.
But I, you know, I appreciate he was probably in a pretty awful position. What did the two of you make of that situation?
He should have done what we have a think tank in Australia called Aspie, and they just call themselves independent, and they get away with it. So I think he should have just taken a leaf out of their book. Of course, you know, they are they have close links to the Defense Department and other private backers as well. But so the idea that someone that has some affiliation to organization that comes within the United Front Work Department, that, you know, is a state body, I guess, if that's the standard that we're going to apply, then I think we have a lot of work to do to clarify who is actually engaging in this debate and the interests that they represent. I'm more than happy with the idea that organization, institutions have interests that influence the way in which people present themselves in these discussions and so on. Everything I do as a historian is, you know, designed to train my students to take those factors into account, make allowance for them, and then interpret the information that they're presented with. I just think there's been so much emphasis on that side of the debate. People seem, at the same time, very resistant to discussing the possibility that there are people out there with institutional interests in exaggerating the China threat. I think that's also an aspect that we have to look at.
I think it's also important to add that this is one area where scholars will typically, and it's very important that China scholars will go to the original Chinese language source materials and look at what the party is saying about these types of issues, look at United Front Work regulations and other, you know, what's on the United Front Work site. That is important. But at the same time, it's really important to bear in mind that being within the target range of United Front Work and doing something that is in accordance with China's interests does not necessarily mean that you are carrying out United Front Work. For example, you know, Chinese students at an Australian university who, you know, might say raise some kind of question, as I mentioned, of their lecturer, and as they would see it, that's they're taking patriotic action to sort of uphold the image of the motherland or the ancestral land, and that is very much in accordance with the stated goals of United Front Work in, you know, numerous documents that identify Chinese overseas students as being an important target of United Front Work. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're doing it because of being targeted by United Front Work. So again, it's kind of like I was talking about last podcast about the counterfactual. Can you be sure that the Chinese students would not have raised patriotic objections to their lecturers if it wasn't for the Chinese government policies on trying to target overseas students to become, you know, more aggressively patriotic overseas? You have to consider whether they did that because the government told them to, or whether in fact it's possible that they had patriotic feelings anyway and that they were going to do that anyway, because otherwise it gets very dangerous, and you're sort of looking at a situation where you're going to kind of impute someone's motives and sort of take away their rights to free speech, essentially, in a context like Australia, on the basis of an imputation that their views just align with, or, you know, correlate with those of a foreign government.
That's right. So, guys, do you see any evidence that China has learned anything from this experience, that the UFWD or any of the other organs have backed off appreciably, or have, you know, recalibrated their strategies or their approach, whether in Australia or in the US, or maybe that they should rethink that, or man, they really clearly have encountered a pretty substantial obstacle. Do you see that anything's changed?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I'm going to just jump in on that and say I don't think so, because I think the latest incident, for example, over the pool painted with the Taiwan flag fish on it, just clearly shows that the cadres out there who have responsibilities are kind of interpreting their instructions as including continuing to assert China's politically correct positions overseas,
doubling down
with increasing force. And we've also seen it in the merging of the overseas Chinese Affairs Office into the United Front Work Department. They're obviously not that afraid of the label United Front Work being bandied around.
You know, this is really, it's terribly unfortunate, but I think it, so much of this grows out of this problem that, I mean, I've talked about that in the talk that I gave, where there's this terrible incongruence between Chinese ideas of nationality, of civilization, of ethnicity, of culture. The borders don't match. There's a lot of spillover. And we're seeing that. I mean, you know, whether you're talking about Stern Hu from a few years ago or people like me, where there's some sort of claim that China makes on its overseas communities that doesn't comport with our idea of Westphalian nation states. And this is a source of a lot of problems. And I just don't see China resolving this anytime soon. It's very unfortunate.
Now, the expectation is that, you know, overseas Chinese are only going to increasingly be, increasingly loyal to the motherland.
Right.
And boycott Gap if they put the wrong thing on their T-shirt. So we're getting towards the end. Maybe we could end with a question about where you see things going in Australia from now. Is this rancor likely to increase, and will the rift in the China watching community, will it widen? What's your forecast, both of you?
Well, as I said, I think that there are, you know, serious geopolitical questions at the heart of this, and they're not going away. I think that there is a serious debate to be had in Australia about the viability of the American alliance. I think that we really need to be looking for ways forward for the Asia Pacific region that take us away from the possibility of economic conflict turning into military conflict. This is something that I think Australia could play a positive role in. Current policy settings, though, would seem to indicate that's not the direction that we're heading in. We have a Prime Minister who has said that we have the closest possible military and security relationship to the United States. And the Labor Party, there's no serious debate about that within the Labor Party.
It's all doubling down.
Yeah. So in that sense, I think that we as China scholars have a role to continue to keep up our criticism, our critical role in society, to sort fact from fiction, to question elements of framing, all at the same time, you know, enacting our responsibility as scholars to defend academic freedom, to defend the ability for everyone in Australia to contribute to this debate. I think that we can do that. In fact, I think there are a lot of opportunities here for us to actually take these questions and make Australian society a whole lot better. I mean, I'm all for restrictions on political donations. I'm all for, you know, making it harder for cashed up businessmen to restrict the publication of books. And so all of these things are actually opportunities that we can grasp and, you know, improve Australian society for everyone.
I'm sure he was going to say cashed up bogans there for a second. That's my favorite phrase from Australia. That was great. You know, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us again. David, great to finally have you on the show. I mean,
Next time, Xinjiang, please.
Yes, Xinjiang, definitely. Next time, absolutely. Before we pack up, let's make some recommendations. And before we do that, I do want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. Sign up for SubChina Access and show your support for Seneca and for the site and for the newsletter. Check out our growing catalog of podcasts in what we're now calling the Seneca Network. In addition to Caixin Seneca, we've also got the Pandaily Tech Buzz China with Rui Ma and Yiying Liu, who are giving a really quick lowdown on the week's top tech news. Find it all wherever you get your podcasts. Recommendations, Jeremy, why don't you kick us off?
Okay, I would, as somebody who's never really been interested in martial arts, I was quite surprised to really enjoy a book that I was sent a review copy of called Bruce Lee, A Life.
Oh, I got that one too. I haven't read that. It's good.
It's fantastic.
Huh? Oh, wow.
You know, all kinds of details that I didn't know, that, like, such as Bruce Lee has got a bit of Jewish blood.
Bruce Leibowitz.
The author is Matthew Polly, and it's, you know, even if you're not, I'm not at the faintest bit interested in kung fu movies or Bruce Lee or martial arts, but I really, really enjoyed the book, and maybe I will become interested from now on.
You know, I mean, just relatedly, Ron Amitter has that new series called Chinese Characters, where he does sort of Chinese history and 20 Chinese lives. One of them is Bruce Lee. I heard it. It's, you know, it's like 13, 14 minutes long, but it's really good. I mean, I learned a lot from listening to this as well. I had very little knowledge about the man. Fascinating. David, what do you have for us?
Well, we didn't get much chance to talk about Xinjiang today, and it is on my mind a lot because of the terrible situation there at the moment. So it's just hot off the press. I haven't even had time to read it fully myself, but there's research out just today by a German scholar by the name of Adrian Zenz. And Ryan Thumb, my friend and colleague, he has a follow-up piece in the New York Times. And this is dealing with the issue now that's on everyone's minds, the question of Uyghurs being rounded up and put into re-education camps. I don't know how much education's going on. These are camps that people have been thrust into. Most people with no real idea about how long they're going to be there for. Various types of routinized political training activities include, and as well as some pretty harsh physical treatment as well. So from what we can gather, this is something I think everyone who engages with China these days has to be aware of. Everyone who's having conversation about state of affairs in China today, this is something to bring up. Adrian Zenz has done a really good job of trawling through a lot of information about tendering process to get at some of the questions about the scale of this, the numbers of people involved. And apparently some of that information has already been pulled off the internet now. So I guess he must be onto something. So I want to congratulate those guys for doing that and recommend it to everyone.
That's terrific. And I do want to remind people that we talked to an AP reporter named Jerry Shi, who did a pretty extensive story about this specific issue. It's a series, really. And that was from a few months ago.
Yeah, that was
we'll
a great show.
We'll make sure to put a link on. Thank you.
But we would definitely like to have you back again, David, to speak with your major
focus
rather than open lessons.
Visit Ryan down in Durham while you're down here. I mean, let's do it. We'll come into the Seneca South studio and do a recording on this.
For sure.
Very, very good. Great. Andrew, what do you have for us?
Well, in keeping with the Australian theme, I'm going to recommend something released last week by the Lowy Institute called the Asia Power Index.
Oh, wow. That was so much fun to play with.
It's a lot of fun to play with. And I think that's one of the really strong points about it is the way that it actually lets you, because at the end of the day, these types of indices, quantifications of intangible things like power, ultimately, there's a level of arbitrariness to them. And so one thing that's really impressive about that is the way that it allows you to play around with the weightings according to your own views of what matters more and less. I also think that some of their measures are actually quite interesting. They actually went to the trouble of checking the Google sort of prominence or the Googleability. Is that the right word? The Googledness of each country, which I think is actually a really interesting and potentially very useful index.
Not a lot of people Googling Laos, I guess.
Right, precisely. Levels of prominence in other countries' citizens' minds.
Right.
Of course, they would need to have done it for Baidu instead
For China,
Google in China. Another one was visa-free entry agreements. So the ability to travel visa-free to other countries as being
I bet that correlates a lot with a lot of other power sort of indices. Right?
Yeah, I just thought that cultural power is always one of these really amorphous and kind of vague concepts. So I was impressed by the way that they went about trying to actually get some handle on it.
That's a great recommendation. Yeah, somebody, a listener actually, sent me a link to that, and I spent a good hour just sort of futzing around with it. Tons of fun. That's a great, great recommendation. I want to recommend a book called Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right by a Berkeley sociologist named Arlie Russell Hochschild. It takes its place alongside a number of books that try to sort of scale the empathy wall and take us into the mind of the Trumpist. I mean, in this case, it was pre-Trump is the Tea Party. Trump is a figure in it. You know, he's already launched his candidacy at the time this book starts. And You know, she does extensive interviews with Tea Party activists and with extraordinary folks in a couple of parishes in Louisiana. And she comes in really interested in this one thing. These are places that are so toxic in terms of what the oil refineries there have done to the environment, just killed all the aquatic life in the bayous where they're living, where people have just ridiculous rates of cancer. And yet they are dead set against environmental regulation. They're anti-EPA. They see, you know, the sort of the tree hugging liberals as the problem, despite having suffered so much. So she comes in looking at that inconsistency and sees how it's not really able to surmount the narrative that they have about being in line and waiting their turn, and then the liberal establishment having helped these other people to jump the queue in front of them. It's really quite powerful. And as somebody who's always sort of advocated for cognitive empathy in thinking about Chinese people, I mean, I think I'd be a hypocrite if I didn't, you know, encourage us to do the same. Although, you know,
you often say that fuck those people.
I do.
If I may quote directly.
I do.
So yeah, perhaps you could do with
a bit
more cognitive empathy for those. Fuck them empathetically, at least.
It's a more valuable book, I think, than the other one that gets mentioned a lot, which is J.D. Vance's Hillbilly Elegy. This is very good. David Brophy and Andrew Chubb, thank you guys so much for taking the time to talk with us about this really, really, really important issue.
Pleasure. Thanks, guys. It's been fun.
Yeah. David, what's your Twitter handle again, if you want to get people?
I am on Twitter. I go by Dave Brophy.
Okay.
I tend to alternate, but on Twitter, I'm Dave. So just Dave/Brophy.
Underscore.
That's me. Dave underscore.
Underscore.
Underscore yeah. Brophy.
Okay. And then Andrew, yours is Jubo Chubo. Sorry.
Z-H-U-B-O-C-H-U-B-O. Well remembered.
Okay. All right. Excellent. And thanks. And we hope to have you back again soon. Jeremy, man, great to see you in New York over the past couple of days.
And you're flying off to Prague tonight.
I am going to Prague, yeah. It'll be fun. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldkorn. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News. And don't forget to leave us a positive review on iTunes or wherever it is that you go to get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.